Praise the sea, but keep on land. George Herbert. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank everyone for joining me this week. I appreciate the support. If you're a newcomer, welcome again. Please peruse our backlog of episodes, and if you're a returning listener, thank you guys so much as always. Your support really means a lot. So, to help with that support, please continue to like, download, rate 5 stars, subscribe, whatever your service of choice asks you to do to support your creator. I ask that you please do so. This week's episode, we'll be talking about developments in what is now Korea between the years of 6 and 4000 BC, BCE, whichever you prefer. We also may start moving into what is now Japan as well, though that may not happen until next week. We're just going to have to kind of play it by ear and see how long the episode is. Before we go on to that, though, I did have one thing I did want to talk about when discussing the Chinese gods. And I'll try to remember to include a timestamp if this goes on a little longer than a minute or two. So when I didn't bring this up explicitly in the episode, but if you watched it on YouTube, you would have seen some depictions of the three sovereigns I listed last week. And two of them, specifically the earthly and human sovereigns, they are humanoid, but they do have some animalistic characteristics. The heavenly sovereign depiction I used was of a statue that was explicitly human. Now, as you might guess, depiction of these figures changed over time, and they also differed based on regions. In many Chinese myths of the past, ancient humans were considered to be more animalistic and wild, so it makes sense for their rulers to be the same way, though they're usually associated with dragon or dragon-like figures. The picture of the earthly sovereign I used, it's a human with kind of dragon-like claws, and he has kind of horns. The human sovereign is very animalistic. He's kind of like a hairy dragon, essentially. And there are depictions of the heavenly sovereign where he's a man, but he has scales. So I didn't mention that explicitly in the episode, but I did want to make that case. Though, again, there are just fully humanoid depictions of those individuals as well. Those were just some of the ones I chose, and I forgot to bring that up last week. So just wanted to put that out there, make that clear for anyone that may have been confused or, kind of bring that up, because we will come back to that kind of thing later. Now, on to the Korean Peninsula, or specifically to the Julmun period of Korean history. Now, Julmun refers to the comb patterns found on the pottery in the peninsula during this period. Again, also, first and foremost, the standard disclaimer. This is just discussing settled groups or semi-settled groups. There are, of course, still plenty of mobile hunter-gatherers who aren't leaving as much of a archaeological impact, and this is not meant to discount them, but there's not a lot to cover on them that's too different from what we've discussed, in the past. Also, as you may have guessed, due to, just to put this lightly, due to numerous political reasons, we're missing a lot of information on North Korea during this period. So far, I'm not aware of any archaeological sites in North Korea, at least dating to this period, or any at all, really, but just wanted to, again, kind of make that explicit. So there's a lot we're missing on this period in Korea. Now, we discussed the first part of the Julmun period last season, and this time frame is referred to as the incipient Julmun, this was developed by people who are already living in the peninsula. It doesn't appear that they came from outside of Korea. They had probably been either in the peninsula or traveling to the islands to the south. And as we've discussed in other episodes, both this season and last season, the rising sea levels have covered parts of places where people were living. So these could have been people coming up from areas that are now underwater. They could have traveled by boat from Japan, or what is now Japan. And there are definitely links between the Jomon peoples and the Jomon peoples of Japan. Though what those exact links are, it's hard to say. They were isolated also to an extent from each other, as well as other groups in East Asia. Though I don't think they were quite as isolated from each other as they were from other groups. But that is something, that future research, I'm sure, will eventually kind of, make clearer. I don't know if we'll ever get a 100% accurate picture, but just take that as well. Now, for this season, we're going to enter what's known as the early Jomon phase, and it will last until around 3500 BC. And this is still considered part of the Mesolithic. The full Neolithic probably doesn't begin until the next phase of Jomon development. Now, over the course of this season, the number of Jomon sites increase. Now, it's also important to note that this isn't like a tightly compact proto-civilization. This term is specifically referring to people creating or using this similar style of pottery. And the Jomon sites are spread across the south of the Korean Peninsula and the island of Jeju, as well as many of the other smaller islands along the coast. Now, some of these sites are inland in mountains, and others are along the coast and rivers. And, depending on where you live, your lifestyle is going to be different. And these include sites found at Amsadong, Osunri, Dongsamdong, as well as many others. And as the number of sites increase, they become more permanent, though all of these sites do see periods where they're abandoned and they're reoccupied. And we're not talking about for super long periods. We're talking maybe maybe 100 years or so, then they're abandoned and then they'll come back. So some of these sites may have been occupied, by the same groups of people. Or one group left, stayed somewhere else, and then another group moved in maybe a short time later. It's hard to say. But as the number of sites increase, they become more permanent. And eventually, at later periods, they're all permanent, though that doesn't again happen in this early phase. Now, as this happens, their houses become better made. They become sturdier. They all have pit flooring, so they will dig down and kind of make similar houses to what we've seen in some of those places in northeastern China, or what is now northeastern China, Mongolia, that area. There is no evidence of agriculture during this period. Instead, hunting and gathering is still their primary source of food. But during the tail end of the incipient period, you begin to see an increase of shellfish at coastal and riverine sites. And this begins to rise at other places. And the amount of shellfish showing up is larger, comparatively. And during the early phase, even after shellfish becomes important, the coastal sites, you'll begin to see fishing become more important as well. Like, not just shellfish, but actual fishing. And there is evidence that they have even begun to build ships solely to go out to sea and begin to fish off the coast. And then they'll return and, bring their harvest in that way. So it's apparent that their population is growing to an extent that they can't just maintain it through hunting and gathering. And we don't begin to see any sort of agriculture at any Jomon site during this period. In fact, I don't know that even during the next phase, and we'll get into this next time, but there's even a debate if you know, that that second phase or third phase of Julman occupation even begins to fully practice agriculture either. But also, another advancement you'll see is that their pottery, they still keep the cone patterns. However, they're incising a lot more, and the designs of these cones become much, much more intricate. And I'll include pictures of that in the video as well. Now, sadly, I wasn't able to find out too much about their burial practices. For this period of Julman history, there isn't really much literature that I could find in English that specifically mention what they did with their dead. We do have evidence for the next phase of Julman development, where they are burying their dead with grave goods, but that is not something that shows up, at least so far that we found, in the archaeological record for this early Julman period. Now, there is some environmental reasons why agriculture may not have spread here. Well, part of the reason it may have spread is that people practicing agriculture may not just have been interacting with them, but also there may not have been a need for the Julman to begin to, you know, try to more closely control their crops. Right around 5000 BC, this period is, it's a little bit more warmer and humid, so there may have been, you know, more than enough food if you would add in things like fishing and harvesting shellfish. So they may not have been, you know, too bothered about gaining food through, you know, agriculture. And that's something that you'll kind of see mirrored in Japan, which we haven't been going that long. So let's go ahead and start the next discussion on the Jomon in Japan. Now, I've mentioned before about I've mentioned before about the similarities between the Jomon and the Julmun in Korea. The name also kind of has a similar origin in terms of basically the name of the pattern on the pottery is what gives the name to the culture or the material culture. In this case, it's like straw rope pattern is kind of what the Jomon etymology comes from. So obviously the patterns are different, but the origin of the name coming from the pottery is the same. And again, there's probably some degree of relation between the Julmon and the Jomon, though, again, how closely related. From the DNA testing, they're from, a similar ancestor population. They're from the same ancestor population, and they broke off from one another. Though, again, I think there is some evidence of possible interactions, at least on a very small level, between the two groups in certain areas. Now, the Jomon period lasts much longer in Japan than the Julmun period does in Korea. Their incipient phase started way back in around 13,000 BC, and it lasted to about 8,500. And last season, we talked about the initial Jomon, and that is ending completely during this season. It ends around 5000 BC. And now we're entering into the early Jomon phase. Though, again, it's important to note that some of these sites are not developing at the same rate. Some sites are entering their initial phase earlier, and then other sites are entering the early phase earlier. So just keep that in mind. This is not 100% uniform. And some sites are not continued all throughout Jomon history. Some sites are completely abandoned during certain phases, or maybe they're abandoned for a period of like maybe that during the initial and early phases, and maybe they come back during the middle or the final phase or the late phase. It's all kind of over the place. So keep that in mind as well. One of the big differences between the initial Jomon and the early Jomon period is the expansion, but the variety of pottery. You begin to see more regional variation between all of the Jomon sites. A lot of the initial Jomon pottery, in fact, most of the ones that we found, all had pointed bottoms. And again, they had that kind of comb pattern incised on the bodies of the objects. And that still exists, but you'll see some places as they begin to transition to the early Jomon, they will have flat bottoms. That's like one of the big giveaways that this is kind of an early Jomon thing. And then as that progresses, you know, they begin to get more intricate in their designs. They begin to have more intricate lips and handles and carrying places where you tie ropes into them. But they're still fairly similar in terms of coloring between the initial and early phases. And when you get to the middle Jomon, you get a lot more variety of colors. I think the biggest places where you see the early Jomon sites begin to experiment with new varieties of pottery, these are in the northern Tohoku region and in the southern Hokkaido region. And I'll make sure to put a picture of that kind of, or at least one of those places. The ones I was able to see were from the Sanai Maruyama site, which I believe is in Tohoku, which is, again, the Tohoku is the northern region of the Big Island of Japan, Honshu, and Hokkaido is the region, or is the island that borders Tohoku. So it would make sense that, you know, you would see the variation, honestly, there first, because this is kind of disconnected from the, I guess, the heartland of the initial and the incipient Jomon. These are people kind of striking out on their own, going further away from other sites. So, you know, them not being connected, you know, it makes sense for them to kind of develop their own regional culture. And that's something you'll see even later in Japanese history. These places, they all have their own local flavor, even in the historical period, even when Japan is, you know, ruled by a more centralized state. Also, about the Sanai Maruyama site, it is an early Jomon site. It's kind of founded towards the transitional period between the early and middle Jomon periods, but I don't think it's first occupied during this season. It doesn't show up until around 3900, so 100 years, you know, after this season ends. But it is kind of a prime example of, you know, the height of the early Jomon, even though it's kind of towards, you know, the period where the early Jomon is beginning to make this transition to the next phase of Jomon development. Now, it's during this period that you again begin to see more permanent houses. They are pit dwellings, much like, you know, other places we've talked about this season, specifically the Jomon. They are, or were, about 3 to 4 meters in diameter, and about 10 to 13 feet, I guess, in Imperial. Some of these places were very big. I think some of these sites have had they've discovered over 500 of these dwellings, though some may have been used for storage rather than actual homes. And some of these places may have even had longhouses. These longhouses, I don't think, are very common in the early period. I think this is something more that you'll see during the middle Jomon phase. But there may have been some of them during this early period as well. What these were used for is a matter of debate. Some people say that they were like meeting houses for the whole community. Other people think that they may have been more primarily workshops, or it could have been both. It's certainly possible, though there's always the question of what was it used more often for. Now, it's also during the early Jomon period that we get the emergence of burials. We begin to see them much more commonly than I think you do in the initial and the incipient Jomon phases. And this pattern emerges in the early Jomon, and it will last through to next season as well. But the people are buried in pit graves. They are all adults, and they're arranged in rows, and they were made in the settlements. And this is true, again, during the early and the middle Jomon period. Now, this does change as time goes on, but we'll talk more about that later. And the Jomon sites are almost all fully settled. Like, there's very little evidence of, like, intentional abandonment and reoccupation for sites that, you know, are founded during this period. And they're usually small clusters of villages, though, again, as time goes on during this season, you begin to see some of these villages become more important. They become larger, and it appears that they may have been supported by some of the smaller ones. Though, what level of support and why that happens is a little bit of a mystery and is debated. Now, in terms of food production, again, the very similar to the Jomon, the incipient and initial Jomon phases see a lot of hunting and gathering. Big targets for hunting would be wild boar, sika deer, that kind of thing. And that continues on. But they also, at least in coastal settlements, began to fish, eat shellfish, and that continues into the Jomon period. However, or to the early Jomon period. However, during the Jomon period, you begin to see, again, a much larger population, and it appears that this is caused by possibly small-scale agriculture, probably that early form of horticulture that we've discussed before, where, you know, they're tending specific sites to make sure that their crops are growing, but they're not necessarily centrally planting them and, like, irrigating them and that kind of thing. But you do begin to see that rise for a number of different plants. They were already eating wild tubers, things like yams, but they are also working with azuki beans, as well as probably a form of boriculture, where they're tending specific trees. Nuts, I think, were a big part of their diet. They also were tending, I think they're lacquer trees is what they're called. It's like toxicodendron, I think, is what the term, like the scientific term was it for it. They're growing bottle gourds, hemp, perea, adzuki, among other things. Now, again, it's debated how closely, you know, they were tending this stuff, but it is that their diet is much more varied than what you would see in, say, the Jomon sites. There's also evidence, and it's just at, you know, just at a couple of places, but there appears to be a kind of peach that was found at a few of these sites. Now, there are areas where people were tending peach trees, though, again, it's a question if these are truly domesticated strains or if they are semi-wild. And we've already talked about a place in China earlier this season where, you know, peach trees have been found. So, you know, there is some form of long-distance trade, though it is interesting how it got from Japan to China. Modern peaches don't show up in China until, you know, I think around, I want to say it's like 2,300, somewhere in that range. when like truly domesticated peaches show up. So somehow this wild variety of peach or semi-wild variety of peach got to Japan. Some people think it actually may have come from some people maybe in North Asia. And it came by way of Central Asia, but, you know, who knows? It's just a lot of speculation, really, at this point. Now, one thing we can tell, at least from the skeletons of the Jomon, they are around, I think the average height was around 157 centimeters for men, 147 centimeters for women. That is 5'1 and 4'8 in feet. So men are about 5'1, women are about 4'8. That's not super uncommon for people who have just begun to, you know, adopt to settle lifestyle. Also, they are, their teeth have really bad cavities, which, you know, that kind of leads into them having a more starchy diet. That's usually what you'll see for that. And that, you know, that would make sense if they ate a lot of yams. Or, you know, they could have damaged their teeth on maybe nuts that weren't properly cooked. They've also found a large number of whipworm parasite eggs, which, you know, they probably had very bad stomach pains. Also, their ankle joints are usually really deformed or stressed. So they probably spend a lot of time sitting on their heels or squatting. Their jaws tended to be wider, their heads a little bit wider and rounder as well than what you'll see for modern Japanese people and East Asians in general. So those are kind of the big changes you see the Jomon undergo during this period. The early Jomon, again, their sites are at least, you know, sites kind of characteristic of what you think of early Jomon, they're going to last until next season. They last to about 3,500. So they've still got another 500 years left. They have a pretty good run, all things considered. The middle Jomon will last about 900 years, and then the late and final Jomon, they kind of blur together at certain things, but we'll get to that in the future. But for now, I kind of think those are the high points that we've talked about. So I think that's kind of the highlights. Next week, I think we're either going to start maritime Southeast Asia, or I might do some more kind of Northeast Asia. I'm not quite 100% sure. I've got a couple of documents open, kind of collecting notes for both. I'm going to see which one will be easier to make an episode on, quite frankly, and then I'll go from there. But I do want to thank everyone who came out this week. I appreciate you all. I did want to go ahead and let you guys know ahead of time, the Monday after July the 4th, there will not be an episode. I'm going to be taking that week off. But you'll have a couple episodes to tide you over until then, so I do appreciate the support. Please, again, like, download, rate 5 stars, subscribe, what have you. Been a very good week for the show. We're almost to 300 subscribers on YouTube. I think we were at 297, 296 when I checked there earlier today. We've got a few more regular listeners downloading the episodes just via audio sources. Shout out to my Juneau, Alaska and Hong Kong bros downloading. I appreciate you guys. Hope you'll continue to listen to enjoy. And if you have any questions, comments, constructive criticism, please let me know. You can reach me via direct message on X/Twitter, via email at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can comment on the YouTube videos, or if I'm live on YouTube, which I do stream there during the week, you can drop in, say hey, just lurk. You can ask questions there. I don't mind. And again, we did get monetized on Twitch. I'm hoping, I'm hoping we'll get a little bit of viewership and maybe some ad revenue there that I can use to invest back into the podcast. But yeah, thank you all so much. I really appreciate your time, and I hope you have a good rest of your day and week from whenever you're listening to this. I'll see you next time. Peace.